Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Philbrook Museum of Art opened a new exhibit over the weekend. In Living Color, Andy Warhol and Contemporary Printmaking features over 110 works by Warhol, along with 17 other artists, including Helen Frankenthaler, Chuck Close, Keith Haring, Richard Devancord, and Edward Ruscha, to name just a few. It's really a who's who of contemporary art over the past 75 years. But at the heart of the show is the work of Andy Warhol, with his iconic Marilyns and Mals, his Electric Chair series, as well as some of his less well-known series, such as Sunset and Camouflage. The prints come from the vast collection of Jordan Schnitzer, who began collecting art when he was 14. His mother, Arlene, opened the first contemporary art gallery in Portland, Oregon, and it's through her and her gallery that his initial acquisition turned into a lifelong pursuit, and now his collection number over 9,000 prints and multiples by virtually every major contemporary artist. More importantly, he loves to share this collection with the public. This tour was organized by the Joslin Museum in Omaha and has been on over a year-long tour. It opened at the Philbrook over the weekend. Jordan Schnitzer joins us to talk about his collection and his collecting. In Living Color is now open at Philbrook and runs through January 17th. Jordan Schnitzer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I have to tell you, your collection looks really amazing in the Philbrook galleries. Take us back to the beginning. You grew up around art. Your family had an art gallery. What set you on the path of collecting contemporary prints?
Well, I was a lucky one. My mother, when I went to first grade, went to the Portland Art Museum Art School, where your former director of the Philbrook, Brian Fricio, is our fabulous director. And she went to art school for 3 years and then decided to open up a contemporary Northwest art gallery. So I grew up with all the best of the local Northwest artists. Just like if I'd grown up in Tulsa, I'd say we have fabulous artists in Tulsa because they're wonderful artists in every community. So my first collection is art of our region, and I encourage everyone to support local artists because they need to get that local support so they become and stay a part of our communities. About 25 years ago, I decided to branch out and start buying prints and multiples of the biggest artists of our time. And I've been on a path of doing that since, which really evolved into developing a major public collection that's available for university, regional, and major museums to borrow at their will.
Why prints?
First of all, I love the aspect of collaboration in prints. And for me, I love all the mediums that artists can use. Each one is different. If there's a sculptor in stone, an artist working on canvas, digital prints, lithography, etching, each one is exciting and gives the artist a different kind of vehicle to express their thoughts and vision. In particular, I like works on paper because it's very defined and it's interesting. With all these important artists, as amazing as a Chuck Close painting is, they love their works on paper. All of them took printmaking when they were in art school and college, and even though they can make far more money making works on canvas, they all love the discipline of working on paper.
What do you suppose that is? Is it more unforgiving, or what exactly?
I think they love the technological challenge of the precision that the works on paper takes, and I think they enjoy the collaboration. If you're working on a painting, you're sort of doing that yourself. You're working on prints, you generally go to one of the major publishing houses across the country, and you're working with master printers, people who are trained to really know how to make the most out of an artist's vision, and they have the time technologically. You know, let's talk about Richard Serra as an example, who's most famous for his big Court 10 sculptures.
Right.
Well, his works on paper are breathtaking. He has these black and white images. He wanted a texture to the paint. Now, he works with Gemini, a publishing house in Los Angeles. It took the master printers 9 months examining 200 kinds of paints to get the viscosity, the thickness, that Mr. Serra wanted. How exciting. Roy Lichtenstein, he said, I want to put Mylar on paper. No one had done that before. How do you get Mylar to stick? Okay. That's the advantage of the publishing houses and having that partnership with the technicians working hand-in-hand with the brilliant artists.
So it sounds like you've immersed yourself into all these techniques, too. I mean, as far as knowing how the artist created a particular work that you own.
Well, I've gotten to know most of all the major publishing houses, and they're wonderful to me. I'm generally a pretty significant collector of their work. And then I also am like a Johnny Appleseed trying to get the art of these major 20th and 21st century artists out to the public. You asked earlier about why works on paper. The other reason is that, fortunately and unfortunately, the work of the artists that are in this amazing exhibition at the Philbrook, if you were to go buy their paintings, they are multi-million dollars. The last Warhol painting sold for $82 million. Without commenting whether I think that's good or bad, I frankly think it's pretty disgusting. Why? Because I think it's hard to look at a painting that costs $80 million.
And think of what that money could have done, something else, other worthy cause.
And not think of money when you see the work. And that was not what the artist was trying to do. But the advantage of buying the works on paper is I've been able to assemble a vast quantity of all these artists' work. So if someone's not familiar with Helen Frankenthaler or Andy Warhol or Joseph Albers or Chuck Close, we have work in depth where we can do a retrospective show, a show of decades of their work. And for someone who isn't an art history major like me, but who loves art, I love to get in the mind of the artist. And for me, it's easier to do that when I see a range of their work from their earliest works to their latest works.
And what I find also interesting is the fact that a lot of these artists, when they're doing their paintings, they're doing multiples, for example, Warhol's Marilyn's or Warhol's Mao's. This is a subject he came back and worked in every color scheme imaginable. He did that in paint, and then he did it in print. So really, the prints, we think of it as a multiples, but it's the same process whether he's painting or printing.
You're absolutely right, Rich. Sometimes I'm often asked, well, why don't you collect the originals? And I'll say, well, do you mean the works on canvas? And they'll say, yes. And I'll say, well, first of all of these prints are originals.
Right.
They're limited editioned, signed. Once the edition is done, they will ruin the plate, whether it's a copper etching plate or a wood block or a serigraph. So they're all originals. But the advantage of multiples is, in the case of Andy Warhol in particular, he rallied against art just being for some elitist group in museums. His big theme was the democratization of art. Get art out to the public. And therefore, he used the most elementary technique, screen printing, which is far easier than copper plates or wood blocks. And his editions usually were 150 to 250. And he wasn't getting big prices when he did this work. Like most artists, when he was initially coming to the art scene, he was poo-pooed. He wasn't put on any pedestal like he is today. But that's generally the history of most artists through time immemorial. But Andy Warhol loved screen prints because he could make big editions, get those out for modest costs to lots of people.
And you'll certainly see plenty of Warhols in this exhibit. And when you first walk in the gallery, you see a whole wall of Marilyn's in every color scheme imaginable. As you walk out, you see a wall of Mao's, which were very popular subjects that he did. Have you grown to understand why Warhol would choose a person he would choose as an icon? Was it mainly just he thought of those people as being iconic and he wanted to capture them?
Well, as I've often said in my talks, in my opinion, artists are always chroniclers of our time. Now think about PBS. You have amazing people talking about themes of our time, about Afghanistan right now, Syria, the presidential debates. Artists are no different. Their job, I think, is either one, to do things that just distract us and make us laugh. How do you not look at a William Wegman who does those Weimar dogs and he has them in basketball suits or sitting up on chairs or in funny poses? My gosh. You have other artists like maybe Sam Francis in his later part of his career that are just these wonderful color field works. How do you look at those and not just be swept away like the Anish Kapoor's in this exhibition that are just beautiful objects? And then you have artists like Andy Warhol, who's very politically themed. His work is no different than that editorial writer in the Tulsa newspapers this morning. He was pushing themes of his time being our time.
And so when he's doing Marilyn, he's commenting on the fame and what fame does. When he's doing Mao, I'm not, this enigmatic figure that nobody really knew, yet controlled the largest country in the world at that time, or population-wise.
Well, you've just hit it out of the park with those themes, because I think that's exactly what he was doing. What Andy Warhol would do is he would pick iconic themes, meaning a theme that represented an entire body of thought. So if you were sitting in 1962, 1968, 1972, Andy Warhol was born in 1928 in Pittsburgh. He goes to Carnegie Mellon University. You have to put yourself back in the time when this individual was growing up. What was on the newspapers then? What was he being influenced by? Who were the other artists? So if he wanted to write about world leaders and you grew up in that time, my gosh, Franklin Roosevelt, amazing, amazing leader. Winston Churchill, I mean, a number of them. But no one ruled as many people as Chairman Mao. He may have been a terrible, terrible man, caused millions of deaths, but he led the biggest country in the world under the communist regime. So if you wanted to pick the world leader that represented that time and place, what better figure than Chairman Mao?
Of course, you mentioned that he was being an editorialist. There's another set of multiples in the exhibition, which they're hard images to look at for me because they're not pretty. There's nothing about them that speaks to beauty, and that's his electric chair series where he has these series of almost over-the-shoulder views of this electric chair and does it the same way that he does Mao and Marilyn in a variety of color schemes, and you have a collection of that in the show as well.
Yes, we do, and it's a stunning set. And if you look at those electric chairs, how do you not get swept up into all the issues about capital punishment? You see those chairs that are empty. You think about how they're used, and they look very lonely. They're very empty. And yet he, like with many images, he uses image after image after image. And I think for me, and I believe for most of your listeners when they go see the exhibition, he moves you emotionally by the way he uses these different colors on the same image. Now, all of us have grown up in the digital age from the time of movies, television, and now everybody's smartphone. So he was ahead of the curve when he does those 10 images. I think what he's also trying to show us is how we have grown up with repetitive images and how we react to them. And there's a power of movies. They suck your emotions and they take you on a journey. So do his multiple sets.
My guest today is a collector, Jordan Schnitzer. His collection is the basis for In Living Color, Andy Warhol and Contemporary Printmaking, which is on display through January 17th at Philbrook Museum of Art, and it features some of the most important contemporary artists of the last 50 years, and it's a beautiful show. Let's just talk about some of the interesting things I saw when I was walking through. First of all, we think of Louis Bourgeois as, you know, the big sculptures and things like that, and you have these charming, amusing little prints of what's called Couples, which is just the funniest little print. My Hand, which is an image of a hand on a writing paper, on the old lined writing paper, and Bed Number Two. For people who know her work as a certain way, this is utterly different. And I assume that was probably what appealed to you, too.
Louis Bourgeois, amazing individual. Growing up in France, father had an affair with the nanny, and that seemed to dominate a lot of her themes through life. And she burst through so many doors for female artists. It wasn't like we are today with the equality. But her themes of male-female, relationships, sexuality, dominance, you know, artists seem to always be autobiographical in their work. And why shouldn't they? We're all a product of where we've been, what we've done. It creates who we are. And the works in this show are very delicate and yet powerful, the ones that she does. The commentary about Couples, The Hand. Mm-hmm. It's interesting for each of your listeners to go there and see how those works speak to them.
And it can speak in a variety of ways. You know, you've sort of let out the backstory. All of a sudden, you look at Couples differently. Yeah, another piece that I really loved, and this is something we see usually large scale works by this artist, and you mentioned him earlier, Anish Kapoor. These wonderful prints called the Shadow Profiles. First of all, like his big outdoor sculptures, they have a lustrousness to them. You know, when you think of what's commonly called the Bean in Chicago, you know, it's this gleaming, reflective surface. These prints also have that reflectiveness, and I think that's a big theme in all of his work. What spoke to you about those particular pieces?
Well, the 10 Anish Kapoors are just, in my mind, luscious. Born in India, British resident, he's able to take objects like the Bean in Chicago. He does these big granite and marble sculptures with these sort of crevasses in them. He blows our mind with time, space, and our perception of it. And yet how he can, on a flat piece of paper, do these images with these beautiful colors and this sort of white, mysterious center to them. For me, I look at those, and it's like I'm looking at time immemorial. It's like I'm looking at the future and looking at the past. And they just calm me down. They just are very peaceful and so full of energy in their subtleness. It's so exciting to see people look at those because the colors attract you. And once your eyes focus on the works, then they draw you in.
Right. And what's ironic about that is when you go to some of his big, massive pieces, like a lot of times he'll use mirroring images to sort of create a reflection of what is out there. These, on the other hand, draw your eye in, and it's not reflecting what's behind you like a lot of his pieces are. You're looking deep into the piece.
You're absolutely right. So many of his pieces play on this theme of the observer and the participant. Uh-huh. Because in so many of his works, the viewer, the audience, becomes part of the art. Okay, here he grabs you and he takes control.
And I'm still trying to figure out the process because there's almost like a metallic sheen to these prints, and I don't know how they were made, but it is really kind of it's cool material.
Well, these are published by a London-based publisher called Paragon. They also do Damien Hirst. And they're one of the foremost publishers in really the world. And they have these techniques to allow this precision images that just have such fluidity to them.
One of the pieces I thought were really strong, and I'd never seen much of his work before, and that's John Baldessari, the cliches. There are three of these pieces. And I don't know what it is about them, but they really arrest the eye. Very cliched images of Eskimos, Japanese, and American Indians, yet with this little button over faces. And all of a sudden, it just sort of draws you in so much.
Well, John Baldessari is the foremost leading conceptual artist in the world. And it's interesting, he's actually probably better known internationally than he is in the U.S. Born in National City, a suburb of San Diego, Italian family. He got into art in grade school and wanted to be an art teacher. And he's pushed the envelope with themes. Now, when I say conceptual artist, we have some artists that are very strong painters, sculptors. He is more focused on the theme than the technique. So he takes appropriated images, meaning images in the common, you know, from newspapers, from wherever, and then he manipulates them. Why? I think that's probably half of what it is. He wants to take images and do things to them that drive you crazy. Why? Because ultimately the objective of any artist is to get you to look, think, and see. Now, on those particular themes, for me, I'm looking at three native population groups and how life has and history has treated them and their similarities and dissimilarities. His technique of putting orange and yellow and blue circles over the faces, for me, that's because he wants to increase the intrigue. If any of your listeners think about how we look at people, we look at how they move, and then we look at their faces, and we look at whether their lips are smiling, frowning, eyes. That's the information bits we get to tell us if someone is a friend or foe or what they're like. John Baldessari loves screwing us up. By covering up those faces, he sets us on an individual journey wondering why. What are these individuals in his works thinking? Who are they? And that's, I think, some of his objective.
My guest today is Jordan Schnitzer, an art collector whose work makes up the exhibit In Living Color, Andy Warhol and Contemporary Printmaking. Over 100 works, I think, in the show, on display through January 17th at Philbrook Museum of Art. Some of these are going to be very familiar from pop culture. They've been appropriated and used in all sorts of aspects. Others will be sort of an interesting new journey. One that was new to me, you know, I thought I knew most of Warhol's sets, but I'd never seen the sunsets before, which are very, I don't want to call them plain, but they're very simple. They're very simple pieces. Tell us about the Sunset series.
Artists always build upon the legacy of those artists who've come before them. So the big movement of artists before Andy Warhol came on the scene were the abstract expressionists post-World War II. And the abstract expressionists were trying to reach down to their unconscious self and then get that work on paper, like Rothko, like Jackson Pollock, taking the paintbrushes and throwing them all over the paper.
De Kooning.
So succeeding artists, they couldn't do what was done before them because they've got to be different. But they often pay homage and honor those that came before them. So when I see the Sunset works, two things happen. They're very ethereal. They're mysterious. It's like being on the beach and seeing that when sun is setting and seeing that sort of mist over the sand. When I see those, I watch the light dance upon the work. So I think in some ways, Andy Warhol is paying homage to the abstract expressionists, because those works are not as politically charged as the Maos, the Marilyns, the electric chairs, and yet they're so subtle and so beautiful, and they're just lovely. And he wanted to do some things, I think, that, one, paid respect to those artists came before him, but also were just beautiful objects that just take your breath away and give you a moment of respite amidst the hustle bustle of our lives.
Well, I do want to ask about a couple other pieces in our last few minutes. And one is there's some small prints by Ed Ruscha, which this is the humor of Ruscha. You know, sometimes divining his meaning can be a mystical experience and getting at what he's trying to satirize or comment on. But these three blank signs, one is like a billboard where you expect to see an image and it's blank. And they're very humorous, I think.
It's interesting. Ed Ruscha, L.A.-based. Very good friends of John Baldessari.
Oklahoma-born, by the way.
That's right, Oklahoma-born.
Yeah.
And I was actually with Ed Ruscha 2 weeks ago in Los Angeles. He is part of that L.A. group of artists, yeah, of which he and John Baldessari rose above the others in terms of their national and international acceptance. So he, like John Baldessari, loves pushing the conceptual, loves pushing that intellectual challenge to the audience. And in those works, with the empty signs, it throws us off. Why? Because we're so used to being bombarded with billboards telling us about everything, cars to buy, furniture to buy, pharmaceutical things, you name it. So when we saw those empty billboards, lonely, the sort of vacuous image, it throws us off. It's like we immediately have this response of, wait a sec, something's got to be on that billboard. So he catches us and he makes us think. You know, Roy Lichtenstein always referred to the greatest influence in his life was his professor Hoyt Sherman. And what he says about Hoyt Sherman was, he taught me how to see. So if there's a theme, I think, of all these artists, is they're trying to get us to think and to feel. So Ed Ruscha, brilliant, brilliant man. He uses lots of words in his art. These don't have words. These have familiar objects. Everyone looks at it, knows it instantly what it is. But then you think just as if there were words as to why he's doing that, and you think about the power of advertising, marketing, our lives, windows. Are those windows to some theme? He just wants to get you to think, because if you're an artist and you don't get the viewer to stop and look at the work, then whatever you're trying to get across doesn't happen. If here we are at the University of Tulsa, if the professors can't get the kids to read the books, doesn't do much good.
Well, it is a remarkable collection. It's a beautiful collection. And there's a lot of different things to see. Obviously, a lot of Warhols, but a lot of other contemporary printmakers as well. And one of the most stunning pieces is actually, as you walk in, it's immediately on your left, and it is the large portrait by Chuck Close. And, of course, that is always a fun experience to see a Chuck Close, one of these large portraits, facial portraits, where up close it's abstract, and as you walk back, it brings that portrait into view. It's just a wonderful piece.
I'm so glad you asked about that. I was hoping you would, because there are two big themes about Chuck Close. One is, back to your original question about works on paper. You know, printmaking, etchings have been around, Durier prints in 1560s. I mean, you can see work 500 years ago. And generally, those artists back in the Renaissance and those periods were making copies of their paintings to get wider distribution to a public. Today's artists, rarely are their prints similar to their paintings. Now, in the case of Chuck Close, his prints are similar to his paintings, but the advantage is that on the work that's there, Lyell, that was put through a press 148 times. What does that mean?
Wow.
Well, he gets his image. He goes and works with his master printmakers. There are 148 different colors on that piece of paper. So you take the big piece of paper and you put brown. And brown goes 50 times in that image. So he puts the brown 50 places where to make the face ultimately. And they put the piece of paper down and they have the color there and they smash the paper down on the colors. They pull the piece of paper off. They let it dry. And they do 75 of those. And a couple days later, they take that piece of paper and he wants some orange. And he puts orange in 32 places. And they smash it down again and they take and let it dry. That print took 2.5 to 3 years to do.
Wow.
And therefore, as I mentioned about how exciting works on paper are, but for the publishing houses, an artist like Chuck Close that does 2 or 3 paintings a year, and he probably has a list of the top 50 collectors in the world that want his work. And he probably decides, okay, this year I'll give it to Eli Brode for his collection LA, or I'll give it to Pino or Arno or Ken Griffin or Steve Cohen or all these mega collectors. But the works on paper he does in Brooklyn with Pace Prints and the printmakers there, and that collaboration allows us, the public, to see a work that is so different than his works on canvas and could never be done without the collaboration of a publishing company and the artist. Now, the themes, you've already said. What's fascinating about his work is when you stand away from it, it looks like a photograph. And then as you walk closer and closer to it, you begin to see this magical thing happening where you begin to see images within images within images. And ultimately, if you get up real close, it is totally abstract, totally little circles, squares, squiggles, whatever, that don't have any image. And what I want to finish talking about is, in terms of the audience, is how important it is for every one of your listeners to get their kids, grandkids, nieces, nephews, kids down the street, get them in the museum. Let them see that museums are fun places to go. Now, I know it's tough. The Philbrook has a wonderful collection of old master and older work. And from my experience with my girls, who are now 16 and 18, it was tough as nails to get them to say, come on, let's go to the museum. Oh, my gosh, okay. But with this contemporary work, I guarantee you get the kids there, let them run around, the work will do magical things. You won't have to drag them. Once you get them in, they'll run off and they'll start looking at these colors and these images, and they'll start smiling and giggling. And the kids today need this work.
Well, I think the other point you've made is the fact that with prints, it opens art to anybody to collect, whether it's a local artist or a major national artist or international artist, as you have. Well, we are glad that you have put that collection together and you're loaning it to Philbrook for this exhibition. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous show. Jordan Schnitzer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Art collector Jordan Schnitzer speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Philbrook Museum of Art has opened a new exhibit titled In Living Color, Andy Warhol and Contemporary Printmaking from the collections of Jordan Schnitzer and his family foundation. It's on display at the museum through January 17th. Features over 110 works by Warhol and 17 other contemporary artists. More information at philbrook.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.